I'm so happy to bring you Lolita Infante. She is the CEO of Cat Labs. We talk about her days as a federal agent, crypto cop, how her and her team took down Hydra Marketplace, one of the biggest darknet marketplaces around the world. She goes into starting her own business, into entrepreneurship, what it's like being a woman entrepreneur. We talk about everything crypto, compliance, and more importantly, asset recovery. This is definitely a person that you want to listen to if you're in the space. Let me know how you love these episodes. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. Welcome to another edition of Around the Coin Podcast. We're here with Lily Infante. Lily is the CEO of Cat Labs. Lily, tell us a little bit about yourself and what Cat Labs is.
Hi, thank you, Steven. So I am the CEO of Cat Labs. And in my previous life, I was a special agent with DEA, Department of Justice, and I was what they called the crypto cop or a crypto cop. Back in the day, there was a handful of us back in about a decade ago. And I started one of the first task forces that focused exclusively on cryptocurrency-enabled crime and dark web-enabled crime about a decade ago. And then in late 2022, left and started Cat Labs. And at Cat Labs, we build a cryptocurrency asset recovery software and platforms for government and also cybersecurity software for the private sector and for government.
That's awesome. You're humble now. You know, on other podcasts, I used to hear you say, you're a badass agent. And now you're like, yeah, I just did a little crypto cop. So tell me a little bit about like high school, Lily. You went to both Columbia and Harvard, which is a huge accomplishment. It's actually, I've been looking at a lot of LinkedIns lately, and that seems to be a combination there. Tell me about your academics to get into those prestigious universities.
So I have like a immigrant mentality situation going for me. I immigrated to the United States when I was 12 years old. I spoke zero English. And I went into seventh grade. In the middle of the school year, I was so bored with American curriculum because it was so behind from what I was used to. I was, even though I didn't speak very good English, I was transferred to eighth grade in the middle of seventh grade. So I was applying to high schools when I was 13, when I was 12, 13 years old. So that was interesting. And I was applying to private prep schools at the time, not speaking English. I would go to these interviews and be like, hello, my name is Lily. and they were like, what are you doing? You can't study here. There's no way. You don't speak English. But I was a really good swimmer. So one amazing high school, private prep school, accepted me because I was a really good swimmer. So I got technically an athletic scholarship to go to this school. And what ended up happening is by my junior year of high school, I learned to speak English, thankfully. And I wanted to go to an Ivy League school. And one of my, actually my uncle is a professor at a university. He's a quantum physics professor.
Wow.
I come from a long line of very academic quantum physics type academic professors. And I told them, I said, hey, I want to apply to some Ivy League schools. I told them I'm applying to Columbia, I'm applying to Stanford. Stanford is not Ivy League, but one of the top schools. And, you know, do you have any suggestions for me? Because he was a professor. And he outright told me, there's no way that you're going to get into any of these schools as an immigrant. And that is the best way to make me do something, is to tell me I can't do it. So it was like a challenge to me. So I ended up still getting into Columbia, and just despite my uncle, because I really did not like the fact that he told me I can't do it. And ended up getting into another Ivy League school. But yeah, it was what I mean by immigrant mentality. It's one of those things when your parents come from another country and they drop their entire life to get an opportunity here and to give you an opportunity in America, the American dream. There's so much pressure. There's so much pressure to make the best with what you have. Right. That includes education, profession, anything that I do. I put that pressure on myself. I have to be the best at it, because if I'm not, that means that they just drop their life and move to another country all for nothing. So it's not a really healthy way to be, but That's
no, and I think a lot of that drives us, right? That, like, not dark energy, but that like little bit of a push. And since we lost half of our standard our Stanford audience, who's like, you know, the alumni that are like, it is an Ivy League, technically it should be an Ivy League. Tell me a little bit about, you know, what you think about education now, especially traditional education. We see now you can take any course for 16 weeks, 18 weeks, and get the exact knowledge that you need. But there's also things like access, network, connections. I'm not sure how much that played in starting your own entrepreneurial business. Tell me a little bit about what your experience was in these Ivy League schools, and has that benefited you? And maybe what you would tell your children, like, do you think they need to go the traditional route?
The only way that it benefited me is signaling. It signals to whatever it is that I'm doing, whether I'm trying to raise money, whether I'm applying for a job. It's on my resume that I went to an Ivy League school. So it signals to whatever potential opportunities that I'm pursuing that I am smart and capable, essentially, right? That I'm able to get into two Ivy League schools. That is really the only benefit, I'm going to tell you, in our day and age right now, because of what you said, because knowledge is so readily available. And the issue is, as I see it, is not about the knowledge being available or not available. It's more about how you learn. Everybody learns differently. I am really, really good at self-directed learning. And I'm really, really bad at learning when people tell me, show up at this time with this teacher, read this book at this time. I am absolutely horrible at that. And as a matter of fact, I had to like hack my brain in order to do well in school and in a structured environment. So I'm extremely good at self-directed learning. Some people are not. Some people don't have the discipline to be able to do self-directed learning. And some people are just really, really good at showing up on time and listening and absorbing that information as somebody is presenting it to them. So I think it there's a lot of different factors to this. Is it worth spending $200,000 because you're better at somebody teaching you? I don't know. I at this point, maybe not. It depends on which profession you're going into, I think. And also, like you said, it's also network. If you go into a really prestigious school, you're going to meet a lot of people that are in the higher echelons of society. So you're going to make that network. So that's very, very valuable. Did I make use of that? No, because I was a loner pretty much and a hermit. And I just studied when I was in school. And nobody told me that the best opportunity that I'm going to get at an Ivy League school is to build a network.
Is the people.
So if
you're
I went
like going now, back to you, like yeah. Vigorously flipping through the yearbook now, it's like, I think I knew a Mark Zuckerberg. Yeah, let me see if I can hit him up now. But you talked about working at the DOJ in, you know, the cyber crime investigation, specializing in dark web. You started in 2012, which I think is when most people started hearing, you know, glimpses of Silk Road and other, you know, dark net markets. That was what crypto was associated back then. What were some of the discussions in 2012 at the DOJ as it pertained to cryptocurrency?
So there was no mainstream DOJ discussion. The Silk Road stuff, this was, you know, Silk Road was the first dark web market. It was really the first real business use case for Bitcoin, right, was Silk Road. And It was not very widely known across law enforcement, across federal law enforcement, except for the specific groups or the specific agents that were looking into this stuff. And I think it really wasn't as well known until probably maybe 2015, 2016, when it started getting a little bit more on the radar to mainstream DOJ and mainstream federal agencies, where people started hearing more about dark web and crypto. But when I walked into my boss's office and I told him I want to buy drugs with Bitcoin, he said, "Who's Bitcoin?" It was, you know, that's where I started. There was not a lot of precedent, and I had to build a lot of the precedent. A lot of the amazing agents that I used to work with, we built that precedent for investigative techniques, for keeping up with the technology, understanding how this technology, crypto and dark web and Tor, being used and why it's being used, and how criminals are obfuscating their funds to hide from us, right? Obfuscating their identities to hide from us. So there's so many different variables in a dark web and crypto investigation that don't exist in the traditional investigation that we just have to learn a lot. And we have to create a lot of the investigative techniques that are being used today and teach them around the world. The last 2 years, a lot of my time was actually spent teaching, going around the world and teaching how to do dark web and crypto cases. So that's essentially how it started. I had to look for information. I had to ask my agency, hey, how do I actually get Bitcoin so I can do undercover investigation, so I can do undercover operations? And there was really not a good process in place. Like, my agency was like mining Bitcoin in headquarters. And then the lawyers came down on our agency like, what are you doing? You can't be doing it. You can't be using government resources to mine Bitcoin for undercover operations. You know,
how tricky was it to work with the lawyers, right? Because, okay, if you're using cash to buy drugs on the street, the lawyers, evidence, everyone, you know, they're writing down the serial numbers. How tricky was it to convince them, like, hey, I'm buying drugs using internet money. I just need you to, you know, fund it with cash in order for me to convert. Like, how tricky was that? Were they very much like, hey, just relax with this a little, take your time? Or were they like, okay, like, as long as you can describe it to the world, we're okay with it?
Yeah, I had to make my case, and making my case involved, okay, this is what's happening. Look at, you know, I have to show them the dark web market. Look, heroin is being sold openly on this market. I can go in and buy it. I had to explain to them how the escrow system worked on the dark web. Is in undercover investigations with drugs is that you absolutely cannot under any circumstances front the money. Fronting the money as in give that guy money before they give you the drugs. Right. And that's what you have to do in the dark web undercover operation. That was my first hurdle. I could show them, hey, look, all these drugs are being sold online. And oh, and there's an escrow service, but I'm still fronting the money. The drugs don't come until, you know, a few days later in the mail. So I'm still fronting the money. Fronting the money is a huge sticking point for them. So I had to convince them and kind of go over that hurdle. So once I did, and then there's some people in headquarters that kind of already knew about these hurdles. So, you know, the ones that were mining Bitcoin and for undercover operations. And so sometimes, and there were also, because we had to create these investigative techniques and these policies and procedures for the agency, because they just didn't exist. We had to kind of on the fly create a lot of this stuff. Initially, it was, we just got Bitcoin from headquarters to do our undercover operations. And then after that, when that was kind of canned, we now had to make relationships with centralized exchanges. We have to we have to find a way to procure cryptocurrency for our undercover operation, right? So there's a lot of logistics involved and a lot of different entities involved in actually being able to do undercover operations with Bitcoin. And it's not just as easy as, hey, boss, can you give me some Bitcoin for undercover operations so I can buy some drugs on the dark web and find out who this, you know, fentanyl dealer is? No, it's just a lot of bureaucracy that we had to go through. Thankfully, now it's very streamlined for the most part.
Do you feel like back then the DOJ was kind of leading this type of cutting edge investigations? Could you lean on other countries like Germany, Spain? Like, was there other countries you can lean on? And you felt like people were leaning on you to kind of go through these processes and procedures?
So under DOJ, there's different agencies and also Treasury, and there's other departments and Department of Homeland Security is different agencies that were actually doing these investigations. And there's a couple of agents that were involved in crypto investigations. They were also just kind of paving the way at that point. It was so early. I would do that. I would go ask around and be like, hey, case agent from Silk Road, what did you do here? You know, or hey, yeah. Like. You know, case agent from Mt. Gox, what did you do here? How did you do this? So it was a lot of advice and mentorship that you had to get if you wanted to get into these cases and actually understand what you're doing and pave the way and start paving the way with, you know, these other amazing investigators that have been doing it for a couple of months. And at that point, a couple of months was like, wow, you're an expert.
of experience. Yeah, that felt like dog years, right? Dog months.
Perfect.
Now, you offer training for this specific reason, right? You at Cat Labs offer this training to law enforcement. Talk to me and, you know, bring me, I don't know how much you worked on the case, but Hydra market, the biggest darknet market, I think, by volume, by complexity. They had money mules. They had cash drop-offs. They had built-in mixers within internally. How challenging was, you know, bringing down Hydra Marketplace, and how much of a victory was that internally for the department?
So I started working on Hydra pretty late in my career, and it was probably the easiest dark web case I've ever done.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's the splashiest one, but it was so easy. And I'll tell you why. The Hydra market was mostly focused in Eastern Bloc countries, and Russia was the main user. Russian users were the main users. Russia, Ukraine, Russian-speaking users were the main users of Hydra. So because of that, when you have an organization that is so ingrained in Russian, with Russian law enforcement, where they basically let it run. I mean, that is it's an opinion. I mean, I can't tell you I can prove it. I can't tell you I can prove it. So it's definitely an opinion. But based on what I've uncovered when I started looking into Hydra, it was such an easy case compared to my other dark web market cases in terms of finding out where the servers are, finding out who the administrators were. It was literally, I did it in my sleep. All the other cases, I was like 2 years, 3 years, identifying, you know, OPSEC, all this other stuff. You know, they were exit scam and they would use it. It was so easy, Stephen. It was, and what does that tell me? That tells me that the Russians could have taken it down, but they decided not to. But they claimed to the world that this is a huge problem in their country and it's the biggest problem. And I think they even had one of their detectives murdered. So they were like out for revenge, trying to take down Hydra. But because of the corruption, it was allowed to operate. That's my opinion.
Very similar to like pig butchering now in Southeast Asia. If the scamming is the majority of the GDP in those countries, especially during the pandemic, it's either like they have no other, almost they do have a choice, but that's the only income coming into the country. That's how they're getting paid and feeding their families. It's one of those really interesting scenarios. Was there anything interesting about Hydra that kind of stuck out to you other than like, hey, the administrators are kind of like hiding in plain sight? Was there anything interesting or any other infrastructure, like certain VPN companies, payment service providers, that you were like, oh, this is an interesting or unique part of the case that we haven't seen in maybe other darknet takedowns?
Oh, there was so much that was so unique about it. Every other market that I investigated pretty much had a very similar structure. It wasn't, yes, they had kind of a hierarchical administrative structure where they had, you know, the main administrators, the moderators, but it wasn't nearly as much of a well-oiled machine as Hydra was on the inside. And Hydra was self-contained. You didn't have to go anywhere else in order to procure Bitcoin to buy anything on Hydra. You can buy Bitcoin on the Hydra platform that wasn't available in any other market. So they created that infrastructure with thousands of different cryptocurrency to fiat exchanges that use different techniques to allow you to have a seamless experience, a one-stop shop to go to Hydra. You don't have to go to whatever Binance or whatever, any other exchange to actually buy your Bitcoin. You could go directly to Hydra, buy your Bitcoin, buy your drugs or whatever you're trying to buy. And they even had career announcement. Literally, it was like that. It was running like a Fortune 500 company. It was crazy. It was like nothing I've ever seen before when I started getting into it. It was easy to identify. It was easy to take down. But in terms of the way that it was running and the infrastructure and how everything was so self-contained, they had, like you said, they had an internal mixing service, that's the one thing that was hard because, you know, they used such a sophisticated mixing mechanism that was more sophisticated than other markets that I've seen, that it was difficult to kind of track and trace some of the fund flows in and out of Hydra, which is why a lot of the ransomware actors and cyber criminals were using Hydra, not just to buy goods and services, but to actually just funnel money through. right? You do a hack, you just send your Bitcoin to the Hydra, and then nobody knows where it comes out on the other end because they have, you know, this internal mixing service and all these exchanges that you can use to actually turn it to fiat, turn it to whatever you want. You know, it was very, very sophisticated. They had job openings, careers.
I'm assuming no compliance or risk management positions opening up there. Maybe strictly marketing. Like money mule, minimum wage. No experience necessary.
No, yeah, exactly. But they also had a section, which is surprising to me, on preventing addiction and addiction help and all this other stuff. They had like a helpline for that stuff. And they had an information page about the different types of drugs and the effect that they have on your body and how you can get addicted and all this stuff. It was like, it was very well thought out. And they had chemists too. They were hiring chemists in order to test the quality of the drugs that were being sold on Hydra. It was just very impressive.
For those listening, you said Russian base, Russian users. Where does the U.S. play in that, where the DOJ has jurisdiction? Like, I know you're obviously trying to fight, you know, cybercrime, but, you know, for those listening, like, hey, where does America have jurisdiction to intervene in what they're doing, even though it's an illegal act? Where's the U.S. nexus there?
Yeah, the U.S. nexus mostly comes from actually the money laundering portion, where Hydra as a platform really being used for obfuscating funds on the blockchain by a lot of different criminals. And they don't have to be Russia-based. They can be based in the U.S. I think the Bitfinex hack couple that was arrested a few years ago, they used Hydra as well for that purpose. I mean, there is a lot of that, basically traditional criminals or cyber criminals just using it to launder money, essentially, right? They didn't have to use it just for buying goods and services. It was a really, really good way to mix funds as you're trying to hide them.
Awesome. You had mentioned, and we could cut this part out. Let me just put a marker here. We can cut out the train and the doorbell. As you had mentioned, actually, Binance, which is one of the most notable cases when it comes to fines, $4 billion. And obviously, FTX, Binance gives a little bit of a black eye to the crypto industry. What are your thoughts? Are they trying to make an example of a Binance? Do you think that, you know, these are the type of fines that should be done in order to kind of mitigate other crypto exchanges from following down the same paths, where obviously AML and compliance and consumer funds aren't at the top of the priority list for those exchanges?
There are so many intricacies in the way that DOJ approaches doing these cases, especially cases against entities that sometimes could be perceived as too big to fail. And I would put Binance in that category as too big to fail. This would be if, let's say, DOJ went in and said, okay, we're just going to seize Binance servers and arrest everybody, or even OFAC designate Binance. They could have done that. They could have OFAC designated Binance. And then nobody can do business with Binance, right? Like, they could have completely killed that company if they wanted to. But because of the too big to fail concept, it would just have such a negative impact on the entire industry. And, you know, people think, oh, DOJ, they're just trying to kill the industry, or the government's trying to kill crypto. As a matter of fact, that's a huge consideration when you are doing a criminal case against an entity that could have an industry impact. Right. And actually, they went easy on Binance because they could have done a lot more. They shouldn't have, obviously, because of the industry impact. But there was just so many intricacies involved there when deciding how to go about prosecuting Binance or any other, you know, massive industry player that could have such a huge effect. And I think that the fact that somebody is pleading guilty is a big win for the government, because a lot of times they'll, in these kinds of cases, like against banks, for example, they'll just do a deferred prosecution. They pay a fine. They say, you know, slap on the wrist. They say, I won't do it again. And nobody goes to jail. And nobody pleads guilty, and nobody gets criminally prosecuted. They actually did. I think they really did a good job with that, where they actually held someone accountable and not just, you know, told them, hey, pay us this money for being non-compliant for all these years, right? So I think it was a really, really good way to go about it. And yeah, I think it was necessary. I mean, the FTX situation is just absolutely crazy, right? And FTX was a lot more blatant than Binance. Binance was a lot more nuanced, especially given the fact that Binance did hire and invest a lot into compliance in the last few years, where they hired a lot of compliance and, you know, analysts, investigators, directors that actually tried to implement an AML KYC program at Binance. But what does that teach you? Is that your past actions are still going to be, you're still liable for them. You're still accountable for what you did in the past, even if you try to implement, you know, and do better now. You're still accountable for all of that money that you made in the last whatever, however many years you were operating, not complying with the law.
And that's how they got the market share, right? You don't operate, don't follow all the rules, the slowing down the processes, the legal procedures. So now you get 75% of the trading volume in the industry. There's going to you're going to get penalized for not doing that at some point.
It's really sad. It's really sad too that these companies, it's a strategy that they use. They know the law. They know that they need to comply with the law, but they choose not to because they want to gain that market share. Because they say, okay, it's going to be a lot more profitable for me to operate and to get that network effect and to get people addicted to my platform and to get 75% of all users using my platform and not the other guys that are struggling to get all the certifications and all the licenses and put together an AML program and invest money into that, right? So it's a strategy. And unfortunately, it works. It worked for Binance. They did gain that market share and they made a crazy amount of money doing it. Yeah. So
it works if you get too big, right? You have to get too big. If you're not too big and you fall short, if you run into some trouble. But talk to me about Cat Labs. You're in the DOJ side. You're fighting darknet market, you know, web activity. You're taking down the biggest darknet markets around the world. You say, you know what? Let me start my own tech stack, right? Let me create my own SaaS solution. And where did you see the void? Where did you see that gap where you're like, there's something missing here? I can only do so much on the public sector, but there's that something missing that we need to kind of bridge the gap here at Cat Labs. What did you see and how did you think you can fix it?
So what started happening around 2020 when the bull market started picking up is as the mainstream was picking up crypto, so were the criminals, and it wasn't just cyber criminal, it was also traditional criminal organizations, drug cartels, organized crime groups. They were all now starting to use crypto, especially with the advent of stable coins that removed that volatility and that risk from cryptocurrency transactions. So now they could transfer value across borders without having to worry about, you know, their coins losing value. So what started happening is all these criminal organizations started using crypto exponentially more than they used to. And I kind of predicted this a few years ago when I first started. I was like, this is going to be a really great way for these criminal organizations to launder money, especially having learned the intricacies and the complexities of the traditional money laundering schemes and the risks associated with them for the bad guys, right? Crypto seemed so much easier and so much cheaper. So that's what started happening around 2020 and leading up to, you know, 2022, end of 2022, is we had a handful of agents and analysts in different agencies in the government that knew how to do crypto cases. And because now every case was becoming a crypto case, all of us now got 1,000 cases on our desk because everybody else is saying, hey, Lily, can you help me with this? I think my guy is using crypto. What do I do here? It was not scalable anymore. We couldn't just have a handful of people knowing how to do this. I started understanding that we needed to get ahead of it and we needed to make sure that every single agent, every single analyst doesn't have to get a degree in cryptography in order to be a crypto cop, in order to be able to do a crypto case. So that's where I saw the biggest gap is actually finding and identifying that cryptocurrency is being used in investigations and knowing what to do with that information, with that intelligence to get to a seizure, to get to recovery, or, you know, give the money back to the victims, whatever it is, whatever case that you're working, or identify the money laundering routes for these drug cartels, for example. Is it's not a scalable solution to just have a couple of agents in for each agency know how to do that, right? So technology is the best way to scale knowledge and technical expertise. And that's what I decided to do. I decided to build a platform that helped law enforcement and intel analysts actually identify that crypto is being used in their cases, know exactly what to look for. And when they find it, know exactly what to do with it in order to get to a seizure. And the platform essentially exponentially increases your chances that you're going to find and recover cryptocurrency in your cases. And it's, I think that was the biggest gap that I saw, is just having to look through massive amounts of data that we gather in our investigation just to find traces that our criminals are using cryptocurrency. And this is even for me. I was doing it for 10 years. And for me, it was hard. For me, it was, right. You know, having to, if I seize a phone, for example, from my target, having to look through, you know, their 50,000 photos in their gallery to see if they took a screenshot of their seed phrase or something like that. That is very time consuming. That's just one small example. In Hydra, we see several petabytes of data, 62 servers that we had to crawl through, right? And make sense of the data and find out, like, you know, how many assets and trace the assets. So, and that stuff is not on the blockchain. That stuff is there inside the hardware, inside of the digital data that you collect, even OSINT, right? Open, so any kind of open source intelligence that you collect, or dark web intelligence scrapes and stuff like that. You have to look at it all manually now. And, you know, there was no technology that allowed me to scale that process. And so that's what we built. We built that technology that removes the necessity for an agent or an analyst to be an expert in cryptocurrency to be able to, you know, find and recover cryptocurrency in their cases.
Was your focus here more in the U.S.? Because I've been at conferences and speaking to countries like Chile who don't have access to any tools. They're using block explorers to do their investigation. What was your focus? Starting in the U.S. and kind of broaden, or were you like, there's countries that really, really need this, that have ambitious professionals, get them up to speed while also, you know, catering to the North American markets?
So because we're a startup, we had to kind of have a measured approach in our go-to-market strategy. And because I have the network in U.S. federal law enforcement, that's kind of where we're focusing initially in our go-to-market strategy. But yes, of course, we talk to other countries as well that have the same problems that we do in the United States. We are very careful about which countries we talk to. The platform that we built is very powerful. We don't want it getting into the wrong hands. So, you know, only U.S. friendly, non-adversarial type countries is what we are targeting. And it's a global problem. Crypto is not just based in the U.S. and a lot of the funds end up in other places when you're doing your case. So it would be conducive for other countries to have access to scalability platforms that allow them to do crypto cases and recover funds.
Now, the Financial Action Task Force, Interpol, other agencies that work, you know, with the broader public sector, law enforcement and regulators, lawmakers around the world said, hey, we need to focus on asset recovery. The numbers that come out show that, you know, really around the world, we're failing at the asset recovery space. How do these products that you're creating simplify this process? You touched a little bit on it, but how is it simplifying or at least empowering the law enforcement, public sector and private sector to kind of up their game when it comes to asset recovery? Maybe you could say, like, why are we failing? And what's this, you know, is it just a scalability issue? Is it just like human resources issue? What exactly are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, it's a scalability and a silo of knowledge issue. And I call it, you know, it's human capital. You have a couple of people that know how to do this and they can't do all of the cases in the world, right? So that's the problem. And what we built, the problem that we are solving is specifically in the identification that targets are using cryptocurrency. So that initial, when you're starting a case and you're starting to gather intelligence, whether you do a search warrant on somebody's email account or cloud drive, or you have a bunch of compliance reports that you need to look through and it's 400 pages and you need to find evidence that this target is using cryptocurrency. And in order to do that now, you have to like manually look through these reports with your eyes, right? Or look through 50,000 photos in someone's phone gallery after doing a search warrant on their phone, right? Or seizing a phone or computer or servers, whatever it is. It's a really manual process. And just what ends up happening is not only agents don't, and especially local law enforcement, but the ones that don't have a lot of the resources that federal agencies have, they don't know what to look for. They don't know that a lot of their targets are using crypto. They don't know the type of information they should be gathering even in order to find traces of cryptocurrency used by their targets. So what we do is we have the training that teaches you exactly each step of the way, the type of information that you need to be looking for and gathering in order to find crypto assets. That's not just on chain, right? On chain, lots of awesome companies that are covering that gap, right? But off-chain is a big component. I think it's the biggest gap. So when we're gathering intelligence, we're gathering evidence, specifically digital evidence. What our tool does is it takes all of that evidence. You can plug it into our tool and it will pull out only traces of cryptocurrency. So only, let's say if the person was using Binance, right? If they got a withdrawal request in their email, which wallet did they withdraw to? How much money is on that wallet? So we go from start to finish. We don't just give you, hey, here's the wallet address. No. We tell you, okay, well, there's actually, you know, $500,000 sitting in this wallet in Tether or whatever, right? So we will actually go and ping the blockchain and tell you from this data set, let's say you submitted an email account. From this data set, there's $2 million of seizable assets that you can go, if you can drum up the probable cause, you can go and seize that money. It's sitting there right there for you. So we take hours and hours and hours of manual labor that the agents would have to go through. Not just the manual labor, but also knowing what to look for. And we remove that necessity to know what to look for. So not only are we saving them many hours of manual labor, sometimes days and months of manual labor, depending on the data set that they're looking at, we're also removing the need to know what to look for and to know what to do with it when you find it. So like if it's seed phrases or private keys or public addresses or emails from, you know, mining pools or exchanges or whatever it is, or a crypto app on your phone or a crypto app on your, you know, software on your computer, or you're going to MetaMask all the time, or you attach the hardware like Trezor device to your computer. All of that stuff our tool picks up on, and it tells you, okay, here, there are, you know, $2 million in seizable assets within this data set, and here's how you go and get it. And that's it.
I think that's helpful too, right? When you're thinking about victims of like pig butchering, the problem with the police is like, hey, they don't know where to start. Even if they were given, you know, even if they don't have to break down the door and get that information, they don't know where to start with the investigation. They don't have enough information, right? They just have this address. They don't know what to do with it and who to reach out to. Do you see more of a shift now of public and private sectors working together, like through tools like yours, where you're combining, hey, law enforcement, we're getting you to the point, but also you have connections a lot with the crypto industry, the private sector, where they could kind of, you know, not tap in or API in, but they could also say, hey, like, here's all the information we need. They could take a look at that information really quickly. And you, as you said, if there's seizable assets, they can, you know, freeze the account, put a hold on the account. And now law enforcement has an easy way to get a subpoena or a search warrant or a seizure warrant. Do you think there's going to be a lot more collaborations now with tools like this with the public sector, leveraging the private sector, so there's not so much onerous on them to come up with these investigations?
Yeah, I hope so, because it's super important, and you know, certain private sector entities are better than others and have more resources than others to actually be able to support a lot of these law enforcement requests. But with our tool kind of sits in the middle of a lot of different tools that law enforcement ends up using. So blockchain analytics tools can plug into our forensic tools can plug into our flip platform, like, you know, tools that actually extract data from servers and computers and stuff like that can also in the beginning of the workflow for a case can plug into our platform. So what we do is we increase the chances of recovery and increase the time to discovery of cryptocurrency assets. And we also give companies like Chainalysis TRM and like other, you know, blockchain analytics companies a lot more intelligence to work with, right? These blockchain analytics companies are just going to be swamped with requests now, because now agents and the analysts and cops are actually finding cryptocurrencies within their cases, within the data sets that they're and the evidence that they're collecting. So I think their recovery is just going to be exponentially higher than it used to be because of the manual process that we have right now. In order for you to use like a blockchain analytics tool, you have to know your target is using crypto. You have to have the address already to plug into the blockchain analytics tool, right? If you don't know your target is using crypto, you're not going to use Chainalysis, because why?
That's not going to be 90%. But the cases where the address is staring you in the face is not going to be 90% of your cases, to your point.
Exactly.
Right?
The address will be staring in your face, you know, maybe 10% of the time, and it'll be like a hack or, you know, scam or pig butchering, whatever. Yeah, you'll have the addresses in that case. But in most cases, you're not going to have the address. You're not even going to know that your target is using crypto. So that's based where we...
Based on your discussion, sorry to interrupt you, but I found an interesting point. Your go-to-market strategy is focused on North America. Based on what the DOJ has been doing since 2012, it seems like you're pretty much, you know, on the top, I would say, international expertise when it comes to doing crypto investigation. But we're seeing now, like, we produce a Chainalysis Public Key podcast. Every person that comes on that podcast says, U.S. is great, but we'd rather navigate in a different country and use our innovation. So we're seeing a lot of innovative tools, DeFi tools, leave the United States. What are your concerns with that? You know, working on both sides, on the public side and the private side, what are your concerns with this innovation leaving the U.S., especially when it comes to innovative things like investigations, recovery, and just altogether decentralized application?
So are they saying that they are leaving because of the regulatory framework that makes it impossible for them to operate, or are they struggling to get contracts?
I think they're leaving because of I wouldn't even say the lack of regulatory framework. I think the biggest concern in the U.S. is everything's very vague. So you can start something, you can build something, and 3 years later, the SEC is kind of knocking at your door and saying, you know what? This is unlicensed security offering, or, you know, your tool doesn't comply with, you know, it's very vague. And, you know, the U.S. right now, I think, has a reputation by, you know, leading with enforcement instead of leading with guidance.
Got it. Yeah. So I'm kind of in a unique position here to have an opinion about this topic because I spent the last 10 years of my life seeing all of the bad ways in which crypto can ruin our lives, you know. but I also, I'm also of the opinion that this is a very important technology that we need to grow domestically. And we need to make sure that we are not sending it overseas. We're not sending the R&D in this space overseas. And you're saying analytics companies and other companies are saying, okay, we'd rather just go to Europe, or rather go to another country that is more friendly to what we're trying to do. And it's not going to put so many obstacles in our way to actually run a business. And yeah, it's a problem, actually. It's a problem in a sense that it actually two reasons. There's two reasons why it's a problem for the United States. And I think talking to Congress and talking to our regulators, we need to understand what they value. So when you go to regulators and you say, power to the people, we need to save the crypto industry, don't kill it. They don't care. They don't care about libertarian rhetoric. Congress doesn't care about that stuff, right? So it's just going to fall on deaf ears. So when you go and you talk to regulators, you have to be in their shoes. You have to understand what they care about. And what they care about most is national security. And what they care about most also is retaining the United States authority within the world. And the United States, and most of that is actually coming from the dollar, right? The fact that the dollar is one of the, you know, main global currencies. And that's what kind of drives the American economy and drives America's leadership in the world. So what happens with taking innovation, cryptocurrency or crypto industry innovation out of the United States and pushing it out of the United States into other countries is you do two things. You caused de-dollarization because a lot of the cryptocurrency usage is pegged to the US dollar, especially right. With stable coins. And stable coins right now, like Tether, USDC, all that stuff, all of that crypto usage right now, you know, massive volumes of transactions by the entire world, including Russia, by the way. Russia using Tether and Russia using USDC and DAI and all that stuff, all the stable coins, all day, every day to evade sanctions, right? But if you drive that innovation out of the United States, those stable coins are not going to be pegged to the US dollar. And what is going to happen is that the companies that issue the stable coins are not going to be required to hold US dollar reserves. So you're going to take US dollar and you're going to break it down and you're going to make another currency like the Chinese yuan or whatever it is that they choose to peg that, you know, that stable coin to, more powerful than the US dollar. Do you want to do that? Probably not. Right. So that's one issue. Second issue is cybersecurity. And it's actually something that a lot of people don't really talk about as much is the innovation and the technical innovation in the field of cryptography specifically. So like, let's forget about crypto and to the moon and coins, whatever. cryptography is at the base of the cryptocurrency industry. The cryptocurrency industry is a way to monetize cryptography, cryptographic research, cryptographic technologies. So, and I'll give you an example. For example, multi-party computation. If we didn't have a use case for multi-party computation in the crypto industry, that technology would not be developed. Why? It would just stay in academia and academics would just say and pontificate. They can pontificate about multi-party computation for the next 30 years, right? Because there's no incentive, you know, to actually take it and productize it and commercialize it. That's the beauty of the United States, is that we give entities and small businesses and, you know, people with a dream, entrepreneurs with a dream, an ability to take their idea, to take their technology and actually sell it to someone and make money off of it, right? And that is a really, really good way to produce innovative technology, cutting edge technology that is above everybody else, everybody in the world. And why that's important to keep in the United States is cryptography is the field that's going to save us from quantum attacks by our adversarial nation states when the quantum computer comes out and they're going to start attacking our infrastructure. Our current encryption, which is all based on cryptography, cannot withstand quantum attacks. Like literally every single piece of our encryption right now that we are using on a day-to-day basis, your bank account, like everything, is going to die. It's not going to withstand a quantum attack.
Sounds like your uncle giving you a lot of insight. Sounds like your uncle's like, saving you the paper.
But you need to, so that's why we need to keep that research and development and incentivize as much as possible that research and development in the United States. We cannot drive cryptographic research and development out of our country. Like, we don't understand how insane that is. If we drive it out of our country, our adversaries are going to benefit from this research and development, not us. And we're going to be left like, you know, what do we do now when North Korea is attacking us, you know, all our systems?
They are heavily, right? They're already doing it without the quantum computing. Before we go, I want to talk to you quickly. Today is actually the release. You're a founding member of the Association for Women in Crypto. They're releasing their Unmantle, the panel today. You went through, you know, you had a conversation with them on their podcast where you talked about, you know, a VC basically saying to you, like, how can you be this amazing entrepreneur and, you know, be a mother as well? And, you know, it was shocking, but I think, you know, deep down inside, you probably, like most VCs, are probably looking at me with the same questions. How do you combat that? How do you change the bias? A lot of the listeners here are entrepreneurs, women, men, or VCs themselves. How are we going to change that, you know, the way that, you know, if it's a man entrepreneur, he doesn't have to worry about kids or, you know, house league soccer or, you know, taking their son fishing, et cetera. How do we change this perspective that a lot of VCs have about women and business and sustainability and growth?
It's not an easy feat because you have to change many years of biased perspectives based on actual data, right? There's not a lot of tech women entrepreneurs, let's be honest, right? So when you look at when you look at the actual industry and you see, okay, well, wherever the you know, like majority of the percentage of the math, there's a very small percentage of very successful entrepreneurs in tech that are female. So when you're an investor and you're making an investment decision, you are going to look at those statistics and you're going to think, okay, why is that? Is it because women don't want to do this? Is this because women are not wanting to play in this toxic environment? Is it because women are being biased against? Maybe women are not getting the funding because there's biases against women and not being able to be mothers and entrepreneurs at the same time. So what is it? Like, what is it that's causing these statistics? Because it's not, I don't think it's all about women not having the opportunity. I think I was probably the most unlikely person to get funding. I had zero experience in business. I spent my entire life in public sector and I was a solo founder and a female, right? It's like everything against me. So,
and you raised quite a bit of money, $4.3 million last year, 2023, during what would say is like, it was spring, but it definitely felt like crypto winter.
Yeah. And I think women need a lot more mentorship as well in order to understand the game and understand what let's say, investors are looking for when they're investing and evaluating opportunities. And a lot of the female qualities and the way that women don't like to, you know, toot their own horn, for example. And it goes against them because the men do like to toot their own horn. They will give you these crazy projections about how their business will be a unicorn. Yeah. And the women are more likely to be like reasonable, you know, but yeah. The VCs don't want reasonable. They want what is like the most amazing thing that can happen to your business and how are you going to get there, right? They don't want to say, okay, well, what is reasonable? So that's one of the things I think just women should get more mentorship in order to be more marketable to investors, right? And not be perceived as someone that is less likely to make investors money than a male, because women are not less likely. Actually, women are more likely to make investors money. There's statistics that back this up, you know, in terms of return on investment for female entrepreneurs versus male entrepreneurs. So
that's amazing. So great insights there. You know, we have a couple minutes left. Tell us 2024, what's big for Cat Labs? Features, products, services, or you just, you know, right now you're focused on the release of Cat Recovery. Like, what's the focus for you in 2024?
Yeah, so we just launched our product, Recovery Cat, which is a cryptocurrency asset recovery platform. And we're, our main focus is to grow that, add more features, make it even more awesome than it is now, which right now it's already awesome. I play with it every day myself because I'm like, I can't believe we built this. I would die for this when I was in the government doing crypto cases. You know, like give my left arm to have this platform. So like I'm always playing with it. I enjoy really talking to customers and getting their feedback about using the tool and getting value out of it. So I'm going to really focus in on that and making sure that we're adding value as much as possible to our customers, making sure that we are on top of emerging technology as it comes up. And emerging technology is in terms of how bad guys are using cryptocurrency, because they always come up with new techniques. So we have to stay on top of that and we have to integrate that into our tool sets. And then also we have a second vertical where we were talking about cryptography and the importance of working on cryptographic technologies. That we have another product that we're working on, which is in key management and key backup and recovery, which is one of the main vulnerabilities within the crypto industry in terms of how people actually end up getting hacked and losing money. So that platform, we're doing a lot of research and development on that using fully homomorphic encryption. So we're using a cutting edge cryptographic technology to secure private keys, to secure cryptographic assets. And we're super excited about that. So we're going to put a little bit more focus on that as well going forward.
Your uncle's probably getting his resume already to join Cat Labs now.
Oh, yeah. He loves his professor job. He's cool. Very cushy.
Awesome. Lily, it's been amazing. Thank you so much. We're going to put all the details in the show notes. And we're going to hope to have you back. We have a ton more to cover. So we're going to hope to have you back on the Round the Coin podcast, maybe in the year, and see where you've been, what you've done, and how you've grown. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Stephen. My pleasure.